You're listening to the Fargo Podcast with Jeremiah and Mike.
Oh, yeah?
A podcast dedicated to the FX television show Fargo.
He says, is this what you want?
I think that, sir, is the sound of opportunity knocking.
So put that ice scraper down and enjoy the show.
There you go, now you see it. The inescapable reality. You're trapped.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. My name is Jeremiah.
My name is Mike.
Hello, Mike. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm beautiful. I'm laying on the floor right now listening to Beethoven's Sonata number 23. It's a cold, hard surface that I'm lying down, but the cockles of my heart are purely warmed by the music that's flowing into my ears at this moment.
How beautiful. Now, I just want to warn you, though, sometimes by listening to number 23, it can cause someone to feel, have feelings of being able to say strange and kind things. So I just wanted to warn you about that. It affects people in lots of different ways, I understand. So
absolutely.
Be careful.
I can't wait to beat our listeners mercifully over the head.
Well, I've heard that's the best, really, method to do, is just beat them over the head. So you're right on the right track there. So let's do beat our listeners over the head with a breakdown here of the sixth episode of season three, The Lord of No Mercy. By the way, this one was written by Noah Hawley. I thought I would make that little quite poignant point here that Noah was involved in this one heavily, it looks like. But Mike, what do you think? I think the first reaction you're probably going to have is, holy cow, I just took the lead in our death trap. Death trap.
I mean, granted, it was a very small pool. We only picked two people, but I'm one for one right now, or one for two, in that, yes, Ray, the Stussy brother that I said was going to die, has died at this moment. So outside of that celebratory tone, this was probably I'm trying to debate between whether this or Gloria's episode was my favorite episode of this season so far. I mean, it's very interesting. We talked a lot last week about how the end of episode 5 is that sort of like the intermission or the act 1 finale before whatever act 2 of Fargo is going to be. And if this is any indication, act 2 of Fargo is going to be very eventful and, of true Fargo fashion, very bloody. At the same time, from both a violence capacity and also Varga just picking his disgusting teeth. It's definitely feels like, of the episodes this season, this definitely feels the most action-packed.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not to disparage it whatsoever. I think this is a show that definitely benefits in its writing and its larger-than-life language, especially from a character like Varga. But there's a lot that happened in this episode, whereas I don't feel like an episode of Fargo usually has that many plot points to it, but it makes me excited because, again, we talked about this last week, but I'll repeat it again, things are really speeding up now in terms of progression. We had our first scene with Gloria and Varga being in the same room. I feel like that's not going to be the last time. Now that a major character has been killed off, there's going to be even more stuff that's going to spiral out of it, presumably. What did you think?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was exactly what I wrote down. Very action-driven episode, which is fine. I mean, we're in the second half, like you said. This is definitely the second chapter, shall we say? And I think you're right. This is going to be a very bloody second chapter. You know, kind of like a Quentin Tarantino film. You know, the second chapter is just going to be all blood. So I mean, this indication of killing off Ray, which I think a lot of us was taken by surprise. In fact, the very few people that was able to read some blogs online were also a little shocked that we lost Ray here right away. I know I was, and we could talk a little bit as we get to the scene, but Mike, I have to admit, at first I thought I really fell for the cliche that, oh my gosh, Nikki's going to get it, and I'm going to be up on this death draft. And then, no, churn of events. And this is obviously the circumstances in which Ray dies did not go any way than in which I thought was going to happen. In fact, that's kind of, I guess one of the things I did kind of like about this episode is that the actions in which takes place in this, not only in the death of Ray, but just the way everything is kind of falling out, didn't go exactly the way I expected. So this is kind of nice. I like when that happens. And I mean, it was a little disappointed. I really kind of was hoping that, you know, Ray would die dressed as Emmett, like my prediction,
I know,
crazy prediction
your big
last
theory
week.
Just got debunked.
It was right away. Yeah, this episode. episode said, oh, that's funny, Jeremiah. No, that's not going to happen.
It's really fun as well, and we'll definitely talk about this with the actual death of Rey himself. But yeah, it's super interesting that we have all these, again, converging forces. And like you alluded to even last week, we were thinking, okay, Rey has to die as a result of Varga in one way or another, whether accidental or purposeful. But no, he ends up dying because of his brother fighting over that stamp quite literally and a pure accident. Much like a lot of the deaths that spur the action in the beginning of these Fargo seasons, you know, they talk about at the very end how, you know, much against Varga's claim, sometimes accidents are just accidents, but they send forward a whole chain of events. So you'd have to almost imagine that if this is sort of like the first episode of the second half of Fargo, if it's Fargo season 3.5, then this is our accidental death to set things along again.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really well done. I did enjoy it. Anytime that you have, an episode where there's lots of action going on, it always does keep you on the edge of your seat, and it's fun television. I know it really works well for those average fans who just like to watch a lot of bloodshed and craziness. So this is really a perfect episode for that. You know, it's not a heavily theme. I know me and you talked at the beginning before the podcast a little bit about how even the tone of this episode was a little bit different. So I am perfectly fine with that. So it should be interesting for us to break down. I mean, let's talk about one of the things at the beginning of this episode. I very heavily themed. Now, the title of the episode, unless our listeners can fill me in, I looked around. There really is there's no philosophy meaning, I think, to this title, nor does it have anything to do with Bridge. It's just a clever title, The Lord of No Mercy. You could probably look into it as, who is that Lord of No Mercy? But, I mean, outside of that, there's no any kind of philosophy to it or anything like that. But I do think, obviously, they're really pushing us over the head almost a little bit too much, I think, with this whole concept about the truth thing. I don't know if you want to talk a bit about that, but, you know, it almost feels like they're hitting me over the head a little bit too much with it. Do you feel that way? Because, you know, we had so much of that, even at the beginning of this monologue that we get when VM is trying to explain the new company situation with poor Sai, who did not seem very excited to hear any of this stuff.
Yeah, so what I will say, and I'll actually go against what the AV Club reviewer who I read in particular was saying, where he's like, yeah, I was tired of Varga to begin with, but now I'm really understanding him. To me, David Thewlis is doing a great job, but I'm sort of getting a little tired of the Varga grandstanding, and this, like you said, this idea that the theme of the truth is really beating us unmercifully over the head, much like, you know, Beethoven's 23rd Sonata. I get it at this point, and I love the Varga character, and I like the stories that he's providing, but I mean, you have to wonder, and I don't want to skip far ahead to that scene since I know we have another scene to start off, but, you know, we have this scene where he does three of these grandiose stories in a row. I'm trying to figure out if Hawley's purposely making a point there that his act's starting to wear a little thin, especially from an audience perspective, speaking a little meta. But I would say, you know, if that's the case, I'm definitely buying into it in that, you know, the veneers, any veneers that he had over his slipshod teeth are definitely wearing off at this point.
Yeah, I could definitely live without that. The close-ups with the teeth and everything, it's like, okay, it's getting a bit much, because, you know, you don't want there to be just too much of one thing when it comes to, in my opinion, to your antagonist. I mean, you want him to have lots of different elements to him, and it does seem like, I don't know, there's just too much, especially of the same thing. But I'm okay with it. I mean, obviously, as far as the truth part of it, the whole, you know, what's true, what's not true, and which, of course, fits in perfectly with the theme of this whole series, which we've talked about before. You know, the whole joke about Fargo always is that it's a true story, but it's not, you know, and they make that purposely for us. It's a joke. I mean, so, you know, to me, is this season they thought it would be fun to really hit us over the head with that notion because it just seemed to work really well with this particular story that they were telling us?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think I talked about this last week, but there was sort of like a closer look on Varga last week on the Fargo Facebook page, and they were sort of talking about how a character like Varga has a lot of resonance in today's culture, this quote-unquote post-truth society. So you have to wonder, obviously this was filmed, you know, at the end of last year, at the beginning of this year, you have to wonder if they're sort of utilizing today's themes. And this only takes place, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, but they're saying, okay, this is how we can make a statement on what's happening today within the framing device of our setting.
Okay. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense. I think we actually have talked a little bit about that as well, but they've definitely, like you said, hit it over the head pretty hard, but that's okay. We'll go through this. Let's break through some of these scenes. I mean, the opening scene, I mean, obviously it was very brutal to see. I mean, Nikki's obviously in bad shape, but I do have to admit, it was pretty funny to find out that not only that Ray has himself a vinyl collection there in his place, but he finds it a good idea to keep his gun clip in the cheese drawer in the refrigerator. Now, Mike, is that where you keep your gun clip in your refrigerator? Is it in the cheese drawer?
Well, did he keep the clip in the refrigerator, or did he keep the gun in the refrigerator? I was trying to remember, because I think the clip... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think the gun was on the shelf where the vinyl collection was, and it looked to me like it was the clip. But either way...
You want to keep things nice and cool. I mean, I know it's Fargo, where it's obviously almost an inhospitable environment at some points during the winter, but... I mean, you got to keep that nice and crisp so that, you know, you got to have a cool steely gaze when you shoot someone down. And I think that helps contribute to it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I think from now on, I think I'll keep my concealed weapons concealed nice and safely, and especially the cheese drawer, because as far as I'm concerned, that is the drawer you keep cheese in, right?
Yeah, I would assume so. I mean, I think it depends on, you know, we have a pretty small fridge here. So sometimes our cheese drawer doubles as... you know, whatever doesn't fit in the fridge drawer, including guns, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And if you're keeping your gun in there, you won't have as much room for all that beautiful cheese.
Yeah,
so I didn't think about that.
And that's a shame. That's a darn shame.
Well, after we see what Nikki and Ray here are about ready to go out for their moment of revenge, right away with V, and we talked about this, you know, with the teeth, and he gives us this monologue. He talks about three stories that he says that are true. Of course, one of them being the collapse of Lehman Brothers, this very old bank. Then we hear, of course, the story of how World War I began over a sandwich, and then the moon landing, which, of course, as in his opinion, definitely was faked. Loved, by the way, Sy's expression, like, what?
Yeah, and that was a fantastic just comedic moment, because all we hear is Varga's voice at first. And I also want to commend, not to dote too much on that previous gun-toting scene, but that opening shot that just focuses on this window with the sun gradually rising, and then it pans down to see Ray sitting contemplatively after everything that happened. I thought that was beautifully shot, but I love Varga. And these stories get increasingly absurd. You know, it starts with, as you said, the correct story about what happened to Lehman Brothers, then it gets to... oh, World War I was started because this guy stopped to get a sandwich, and as a result, you know, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, and then it moves to, hey, the moon landing was fake, and then it just starkly cuts to Sy, and you realize the situation that you're in, and it's a nice way to just sort of drop someone into the world. I know I said that, you know, it might have gotten a little derivative, and whether or not that's purposeful is yet to be determined, but I thought it was, from a comedic perspective, like a nice punchline.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we haven't spent a lot of time necessarily discussing things like that, but one of the things that Fargo has always done very well is the cinematography. All the shots they choose, they is so beautifully well done. And even in this episode as well, there's quite a few of them that I really loved. And, yeah, I did notice that. I mean, how can you not with the shot with the window? It was great. And then we had later on, like I said, the outside shots, too, of the two doors, which... was very nice. But yeah, it was it's very well done. We don't give enough praise to all the cinematographers and stuff that do work for Noah Hawley on this show. They do a great job. Let's talk for a second a little bit about this scene with Sy and Emmett and VM. What was very, very entertaining, because like you said, the comedic value, like I said, was so wonderful, and Michael does such a great job playing Sy that I just adore him. You feel so bad for him, because you know things are really, really going to get probably very bad for him, worse than it already. I mean, I can't imagine it getting any worse than it has, since he's had to drink someone's pee, and he's just been, I mean, witnessed brutal things. I mean, the poor guy, he's taken a big beating here. One of the things I put on my notes, though, was the fact that, you know, Emmett really is fully on board. The first thing I wrote down when I saw this scene was like, wow, Emmett is really on board with all of this. It's like he's completely accepted what is happening? I'm in this deal with Varga, and we're going to make a ton of money. Was that your takeaway a little bit? I mean, obviously, what's been going on with his brother is still on his mind most and foremost.
I mean, and maybe, literally, as his voice is literally echoing in his head.
Yeah, so is it more of just because he's been so distracted with his brother that he hasn't, like Sai, who doesn't have any other distractions, is able to clearly see how bad things are for them? Is that maybe part of it, you think, at this point mm-hmm. in the episode?
Well, it's interesting. We're going to talk about, obviously, this image of the two of them later, but I thought this was a really fascinating episode from Emmett's perspective, because we've heard a lot about Emmett and the people that have been whispering in Emmett's ear, specifically Sai and Varga. Mm-hmm. But what we found out later on about Emmett is that Emmett is essentially a people pleaser. The reason why, you know, mm-hmm. he tells Ray, you know, like, I've been nothing but nice to you. Why do you treat me like this?
Right.
It feels like he's really hung up on this idea, not really of, like, you know, what Ray is necessarily doing to him, but the fact that, like, he's the nicest he can possibly be to Ray, and Ray isn't reciprocating that. And that sort of is stuck in his craw a bit. And compounded on top of that, Varga continually makes this wealth pitch. You know, he even talks about in this scene, the shallow end of the pool is where the turds float, saying, like, you know what, no, we have to shoot for, you know, we have to shoot for the gold instead of settling for the bronze, which is definitely not Sai's MO at the moment. So it's we're going to gain a lot of insight from Emmett this episode, but this is one indicator of that.
Yeah, you're right. I did pick up on that, especially, of course, the moment when he was having that discussion with his brother, and like you said, he said, well, you know, everybody likes me except for you. And he's like, well, that's just to your face, which is probably true. I mean, I could definitely see that, you know, Emmett feels that everybody likes him, but in reality, maybe not everyone does. But he definitely is someone who is very, very concerned about that. I have people in my life that are that way as well, that, you know, what other people think really, really does affect them a lot. And, you know, I think that really does lead up to a lot, to really the reaction in which, once Emmett really starts to realize what's going on with his brother, that he actually may have taken an attempt at robbing him and all this. Like, once all this starts coming out to him, I think that's why he was so quick to just say, that's it, I'm done. I got to make things right here. I don't want my brother to continue to hate me so much. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think it does drive him a lot. And it has to be clouding his decision making here, because it's not good. Now, after VMX explains that they are going to hopefully double the company in the next 3 months, and obviously Sai is not happy with this idea. He's so concerned about everything, obviously, and rightfully so, and including, of course, what's going to happen with the IRS man. In the next scene, we get to see VM's answer to what to do with the IRS agent, which, by the way, Mike, was hilarious when we get to see Mimo dressed to this perfectly. I mean, matches the IRS guy pound for pound and sets up his pencils exactly the same way, all to basically tell him that, hey, we need everything in documented writing before you can do any more investigation, and we'd like you to leave. It was just so funny. But I do have to ask you, Mike, outside of the comedic value of this particular scene, are you preferring, do you like talking Mimo, or do you like silent Mimo? Because we didn't even get to hear him talk to the first times was last episode, where he basically insults Nikki. What do you think? Do you like the talking version?
Or do I like finding Mimo? That's probably my favorite version.
That's a good one, by the way.
I'm surprised it's taken us that long to make a joke. But again, he's been pretty peripheral until now, as you mentioned. I like it. As you said, if he wasn't talking, we wouldn't have this hilarious scene where it's essentially, you know, the cold open from The Office in season 3, where Jim comes in dressed as Dwight and tries to just impersonate him. I love, you know, the little mirroring where they lay out the exact same things. I think is really fantastic. I don't know how much that ruse is going to hold. You know, let's say, for example, if LaRue Dollard happens to, you know, walk by the office and happens to see Mimo dressed up, not in a suit, tie, and glasses. Like, oh wait, is that your lawyer, right? Why does he look like that usually? That might be some reason for raising the flag a bit. But I'm happy because I will say that, again, one of the stock things that they've done in both Fargo seasons so far has been the silent character. We've talked about this before. You had Mr. Yeah. Hands in the first season. You had the Kitchen Brothers in the second season. Well, it would be nice to sort of say, you know, everything comes in threes to have another silent character. I'm happy that they're at least not saying, like, and this is the silent character. He's not going to talk the entire time. They're at least building out his character a bit.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering is that do you like this idea? Because I do feel like they're purposely trying to get away from that issue. But the funny thing is they start with that, though, because, you know, we have the silent and then the talking one, and then all of a sudden now they both talk. So are they trying to break away from – is this the slow break of, okay, from here out, everyone, you know, the henchmen are not always going to be the same thing.
Maybe, good question.
Maybe we get him to slowly talk, so we're used to having two henchmen to talk, and then in season four we will just have two henchmen who talk.
Yeah, exactly. It's just Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. It's just two henchmen talking to each other. But I also feel like once you made him talk last episode, the toothpaste is kind of out of the tube, right?
You can't really say. You can't go.
And then
back.
He goes back to being silent, and you also have to remark on the fact that he was talking for the first time. This is a very significant event. And we talked about really how this is a – last week's beating was a giant event that has now set a bunch of things into motion. So
true.
I'm fine with it for now as long as it contributes to building out a character. If he continues to kind of be a blank wall that really does not have much of a personality outside of being a thug, maybe we can look back and say maybe he should have been muted the entire time.
We'll see. I mean, I'm okay with talking Meemaw. I mean, I'm perfectly fine with it. He's a fascinating character. I really want to know what he is listening to on his phone there. I mean, he's very intent. I mean, whatever it is, he really loves it. I'd like to think he's listening to the Fargo podcast with Jeremiah and Mike.
You would hope so. I do wonder if one day we'll figure out exactly what he's listening to. Maybe the actor has alluded to it in an interview that I haven't read yet.
Yeah, we'll have to look and see. But he's doing obviously a great job. And that scene was perfect. And yes, in real life, you would hope that the IRS agent would be very suspicious, even more so now. But yeah, that was beautifully done.
And do you really think that Dollard's going to back off now, that he's going to take that threat lightly?
It's a great question. I thought about that as well when he left. You would like to think that no. I mean, this is the IRS. I mean, I really cannot imagine them saying, oh, I'm, you know what? I'm sure everything's fine. You know, just I can't imagine. I'd be surprised if we do not see him again. What about you? You feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he has to. I feel like there's no way that type of character honestly isn't going out without being in a body bag. So I feel like, and even Brendan Fitzpatrick last week is like, I can't wait. I think of all the creative ways that they can kill him off. So I feel like, A, this is probably not the first time he's attempted to be deterred from his mission. B, it would just not be Fargo if he just got scared away and left.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll see how that plays out. There's just no way. He has to come back. I would be shocked if he doesn't. So as we move along, we get to see, you know, Nikki and Ray are really out for revenge. They follow Yuri and Meemaw to the truck. Ray, of course, wants to act immediately. Nikki wisely stops him because that would have gone really poorly.
So now, you know, I do not want to be this person to question the meticulous details of these types of things, because, as you said, it's a story. It might not even be a true story. But how did Ray and Nikki know where they would be?
Yeah, you know, now that you brought that up, it was something I didn't think about at the moment when I was going through the episode, but yeah, that's a good point.
It would make sense if, from the other perspective, because Varga has, you know, that omniscient computer, he might be able to look up, like, okay, this was the license plate, this is the model and make of the car that they're driving around, even though they just have to, you know, type in, you know, piece of junk Firebird, and you'd be able to, you know, produce a good result in terms of that car. But you'd have to wonder how Ray and Nikki, especially considering Ray's now fired, would be able to utilize their resources. I don't know if Nikki's necessarily remembering. She did remember the car, the make and model of the car, as she told Ray in the beginning of the episode. But you have to imagine there's so many of those cars that are out there that you can't just randomly drive around and say, oh, yeah, that's the car. Let's, you know, follow them around.
Maybe it's just something as simple as they went over to the Stussy headquarters and was just hanging out in the parking lot until they saw the car at some point and then followed it. I mean, it's really hard to say. this town, from the little bit I know about it, is very small. So if we're going on that logistics now, the whole area, I mean, even the city they go to a lot is not that big. I mean, I understand what you're saying, though. It is one of those things that, you know, we couldn't
It didn't distract me from anything. It was a minor quibble for me in my nitpicky nature.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, it's a good point, though. But apparently they did find them. They tracked them down. Like I said, Nikki wisely stops him from doing something so stupid that would end him dying much faster in the episode, I think. Nikki, of course, then later on we see her soaking in that bathtub. She looks just really rough there, Ed.
Yeah.
I saw some other people mention how the fact that the contrast between the last time we see, you know, them and her in the bathtub with water in it. Of course, we saw her in the bathtub at the close of the last episode, but this time in the bathtub, it's not quite as pleasant as it was when they were, you know, goofing around on Facebook together, enjoying a candlelight moment in the tub. This time, things are looking very rough for her. And, you know, Ray, I think, had a right idea here. She really should probably have herself checked in for internal injuries, because that's my thing that I immediately wrote down. I was like, oh, man, she can have some major internal injuries. This is not good.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering as well. And again, I don't want to be too much of like the meticulous Mike section of this podcast, but I was wondering, you know, maybe I've seen too much like Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, but could they just like check into like a really sketchy, you know, low rent clinic? Doesn't necessarily even need to be a hospital. I'm assuming the reason why Nikki didn't want to check into a hospital is because, as she said, she has a record and she knew that could ping somebody to send someone after her, whether it be Varga's men or somebody else. But I'm sure they could find some sort of, I don't know, walk-in clinic that they'd be able to, tucked away in some remote corner of Minnesota, that they could go to get treated.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, but I understand where she's coming from. I mean, I understand why she doesn't want to go, because she is afraid that this could bring too much heat on them. I mean, they know that you have Gloria and Winnie, of course, have been questioning them, so they know that. They know the cops are kind of on them a little bit. And then they have this whole thing with, you know, Yuri and Mimo, the VM's guys after them. So I understand why they're afraid to go anywhere. It just, you know, Ray was right that she probably does need to see some kind of medical attention at that point. And I thought it was funny to hear them break down about what Emmett could be involved in, because even though obviously they were wrong necessarily, I mean, he's not involved in a loan shark or anything, but they did kind of nail the fact that, you know, hey, he probably got in trouble after the big crash, which, you know, we had to mention, of course, of the Lehman Brothers in that story about the crash. So he really referencing, by the way, something that you wisely point out that this season could be about, which, of course, is the financial situation the country was in during 2010. So, you know, they kind of had it right a little bit, but not completely. What they didn't realize is this involvement with this VM guy is put them in a situation that if they really knew what was going on, they'd probably back off and maybe just take that money they have left over and make a run for it and get the hell out of town, other than wanting to get revenge if they really knew what was going on, right?
Yeah, and this sort of segues into this Varga scene, which, you know, I said last week that the P did not disturb me as much as something that was alluded to in this scene. Just watching Varga pick his bloody gums was disgusting. That was the most mortifying thing I've seen on this show so far. It was that's the type of gore that I'm really not into. But again, it's very convenient, because we have Nikki and Ray talking about, you know, a shark in a suit is still a shark, and cut to this guy with blood literally in his mouth.
Yeah, and I'm sure all of that was done on purpose, and it was beautifully done. And when you move into this scene, because we do need to talk a little bit about what takes place back at the Stussy headquarters next, because when Winnie and Gloria come to question Emmett, and Emmett, of course, gets to learn a lot that he did not realize was going on, and you're right, Varga comes in really just kind of tries to take control over this conversation. One of the things I wrote down was he was bringing a lot of attention to himself, and I felt like, because he mentions early on about how he's hardly ever seen and stuff later on in the episode when he comes to help fix Emmett's situation with the death of Ray. So I was really surprised to see Vargas so into this conversation, bringing so much attention to himself to both Gloria and Winnie, two people, you know, or of, you know, officers of law. I just didn't feel like it was like what I expect from him. Did you feel that same way with this whole thing?
I wonder if it's what we, I think, how am I trying to put this? I feel like the means were what we expected of him, but the end was not. Mm-hmm. And I think that even Varga realized it. As I mentioned before, this is his very first scene with him and Gloria together. This metaphoric Peter right. and the wolf are finally together in one setting. And I think he's used to charming the pants or distracting the pants off of them. He's a magician. He's doing one thing with his hand while he's, you know, actually doing a trick in the other hand. And he definitely tried to do that this time with talking about, you know, oh, you know, there were 23 Hitlers in the phone book, and, you know, basically comparing the NS Stasi, Emmett Stasi stuff. But Gloria in particular sees right through him. And I think that spooks him a little bit.
It does spook him. It really does. Yeah, because, you know, if you think about after this whole conversation happens, VM learns two things I think really, you know, messes up with his game a little bit. One of them, of course, has to be the reactions he was getting from Gloria, who, like you said, really pushed back on him, saw right through him. He knows she's going to be a problem. But the other thing I think that surprised him was to hear this story play out. He really was impressed with the fact that Ray's a lot more dangerous than I thought he was. So there was a few things that kind of took him by surprise, I think, after the end of this transaction. But that was the first thing to kind of thought was like, wow, what is he doing? I'm really surprised that he's so involved in this and what's going on with this. But it was very fascinating to see. And I loved the fact that when Emmett and Gloria are having this conversation, how the stamp was barely unwrapped, just sitting there in between the two of them during this entire conversation, which we all know that what was sitting in front of Gloria is the whole reason for everything, for Ennis's death. Everything is right there on the table. So I love that, by the way. I thought that it was a very beautiful, artistic decision to do that. Having the stamp between them during that conversation was great, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, it's very poignant. It's this idea of the butterfly effect that Varga was somewhat falsely alluding to in his opening monologue, specifically about the one with World War I, this idea that one small thing or one small activity can cause an entire skirmish, even though Winnie apparently doesn't know what skirmish means, to happen. So right. I think it's very indicative, and we're going to see that pay off almost immediately later on in this episode.
Yeah, and you know, I know that Varga has an obsession, obviously, with dictators and terrible rulers in the world. I mean, Stalin is obviously one of his favorite people, since he has a picture of him in the truck where he apparently lives. So, you know, it's not surprising that he would use a reference to Hitler. But, you know, if you really want to win someone over, maybe you don't mention Hitler at all. You know, it's probably not the kind of guy
especially
you want
just
to
like
go
a couple
to.
Days ago, you were saying we need to get rid of the Jew.
Yeah, well, yeah, we do know that this guy is definitely, he's a terrible person, obviously, and he's extremely racist and anti-Semitic. So this is not a good guy, so I guess I should be surprised that he, of course, talked about Hitler. But I just, you know, come on, guy, you're really not going to win over Gloria by mentioning Hitler. That's just my opinion, Mike. I just, you know. But one of the things I was really shocked about during this particular scene has to be the fact that Eden Valley has a DQ and a Tasty Freeze. This is crazy. I had no idea. Did you? Are we aware of this?
I mean, I was not aware. This adds to the list of landmarks that we're going to have to go to, along with the non-existent Bear's Den when we do our inevitable tour of the Midwest.
Yeah, absolutely. So the nerd that I am, I did try to do a quick Google Maps search to see where the nearest DQ was, and it looked like it was quite a few miles over from where it was marked as Eden Valley. So I don't know if that DQ really is in Eden Valley, or if that is it looked to me like it was another town. So maybe any of our Minnesota listeners can fill us in if whether or not there really is a DQ it takes. Because I don't know about you, Mike, I do want to know right away where the nearest DQ is, you know, so I could get one of a blizzard. And if there's one in town, I want to know about that as well. Tasty Freeze came up with zero. I don't know where the hell a Tasty Freeze is in that part of Minnesota. But you'd almost, to me, it looks like you'd have to go to one of the major cities for a Tasty Freeze. But I could be wrong. So if any of our listeners want to correct me on that, that would be great.
Great. Hopefully they can find you, unlike Varga trying to find Gloria online.
Yeah, exactly. I love this scene, by the way. No surprise, of course, with everything that they've been showing us about how Gloria is immune to and how technology does not recognize her whatsoever. So I'm not surprised that she has no digital footprint, but to have zero digital footprint was really funny. And the look on VM's face when he was trying to figure out, like, what? And then he's trying to search Eden Valley's police station, and he's having a hard time finding any information.
He should have searched for the library.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we know that the library is connected to it, so I just thought this whole thing was funny. And then, of course, we get to find out, you know, that Varga's plans is that he's breaking up the boys. He's gonna send off Yuri to go to the police station to get some records. He wants to find out what they do know about this particular case when it comes to Ines's death. But then Mamo, who was originally going to be following Sai to this another dinner engagement with Miss Skolberg, then we find that he's been changed to go and take a hit, execute Mr. Ray and Miss Nikki. So I guess my question for you is, if Mimo was to kill Nikki at this point, would I get points? Would I get a point for VM asking to take the hit? See, I need to know this clarification, because I have a feeling that this is the kind of guy who may not get his hands dirty, but he's going to have his henchmen obviously do it for him. I just need to know if I get points for this.
I would say no. Not just me being shrewd, but I'd say secondhand deaths do not count. Unless we get Varga saying, I killed her, then I'll give you some compensation there. But
right.
Otherwise, no, you made your bed with picking Varga. You're going to have to sleep in it.
Damn it. This is really, after, you know, seeing this episode played out, that's the first thing that popped in my head is, Jeremiah, you idiot. Why did you take him? Of course he's not going to physically be... Now, yeah, I might get some points of him dying, perhaps, but wow, what a poor decision of mine. And
It's all right.
I do want to mention, did you see that Yuri had the black wolf mask in his hand? That was interesting.
Yeah, because that was, if people remember, at the end of episode 5, after, you know, Nikki, Ray finds Nikki back at the apartment, it cuts to this sort of, this like overlay shot of someone in a wolf, or looking like a wolf silhouette, smoking, much like we saw Maurice in the first episode. So you'd have to assume that might be Yuri. It might be Varga. I'm not entirely sure. But it's interesting as well, speaking of Yuri, that we obviously saw Mimo's side of the division with the motel. We have yet to see Yuri infiltrate the police station, which maybe we'll see next episode. You know, Gloria has now turned around, so maybe Yuri will have to deal with poor Donnie, and we'll see if Donnie and new chief will see how either one of them do with Yuri. But yeah, we haven't seen that side of the equation yet.
Yeah, I have a feeling I could see an interaction with either Donnie or Mo with Yuri, and him, you know, bringing out a lot of references to Mother Russia, and they'll be very confused during the entire conversation. You're right. It'll be interesting to see if we see an interaction. I mean, obviously, we haven't seen the dinner date, too, between Emmett and Sai with Ms. Goldberg, which I'm assuming we will probably see that interaction and maybe as well in the next episode, because obviously this is going to be a big part of the story. I mean, VM is all over that. He knows what's going on with that, and I have a feeling that this is not going to go well for her. I think she might find herself in some trouble here. I think her empire of... what is she in? She's not in the parking lot. She's in the what business?
She's in she's in like
storage. Storage.
She's
business.
In storage from both a self storage perspective, and also I believe she does funeral arrangements as well. Because that was the whole joke last week about, like, there's no difference between, you know, self storage and, you know, preparing a dead body.
Yeah, exactly. They're pretty much the same, really, if you think about it. I know that's how I feel about it. Anytime I'm in a parking lot, I actually do think of funeral homes and storage units. I really do. So Nikki and Ray, of course, feel the pressure. You know, they first get spooked when Gloria and Winnie show up. They're terrified. They go on the run, right? They check into this very...
Finally.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about that at the end of last week. Like, I had predicted that after this incident in particular, Ray has no connections outside of Emmett back to this area. Him and Nikki should obviously take off. Now, they don't take off very far, but they take off nevertheless.
Yeah, they take off nevertheless, and they stay in the Ambassador Motor Inn. And, you know, Ray, he's just not that smart. He of course, completely forgets to grab the money. And it's funny because it reminded me a little bit of Pulp Fiction when... I'm trying to think of Bruce Willis's character's name, but when him and his girl show back at the hotel, and then he goes, "Where's my watch?" And she goes, "Well, we didn't grab it, you know." And he's all upset. He's got to go back to get the watch, and then I see that Ray has to go back to get the money, and of course, you know that means it's leaving Nikki by herself, and we know that's not a good thing, since obviously Mimo has been following them. And we know this is going to go terrible. So at this point, I really did. I was thinking, oh, this is fantastic. I am going to get some points here. Nikki's a goner. You know, we see her walk into the ice machine. I'm like, oh, this is beautiful. Which, by the way, the Ambassador Motel is the name of the famous name of the hotel where RFK was assassinated. So we have another political assassination mentioned too in this episode, because we had, of course, the mention of the death that caused World War One. I thought that was kind of fascinating. But finally, Nikki and Ray are on the run. Surprising it took them this long.
Yeah, absolutely. And it won't last for long. It probably will with Nikki, though we'll see how things take off from her. But yeah, Ray's time on the run, to quote Hunted, has just ended.
Yeah, it has. So let's talk about this big scene. This is the one. Ray, of course, shows back up to the place to get the money he left in that bag with the poor remains of the dog. Was just sitting there just by the fish tank, you know. I love the fact that, by the way, Emmett mentioned, you know, that was my dog that you just threw in the trash can. He had to point that out real quick, which I thought was great. Oh, man. So let's talk about this exchange. We've already talked a little bit about it. It didn't take me by surprise that Ray reacted, especially the new Ray. So, like, the new Ray is the old Ray. We've talked a little bit about this before. The old Ray probably would have just been like, oh, yeah, bygones, buddy. Yeah, this is good. We're working this all out. New Ray said, you know, F you. You know, I mean, and it leads to his death. I mean, the whole thing is so tragic, right?
Yeah, I mean, you made a great point about the new Ray. This more emboldened Ray as a result of, you know, this desperate plea that he did with Maurice. Now I feel like it's not very Lesser Nygaard in that realm of like him being a complete sociopath by the end, but
yeah, right,
he's definitely a lot bolder than he was before. Mm-hmm. But I think the really poignant line in this entire exchange, outside of what I mentioned before, where Emmett says, you know, can't think of a single person doesn't like me except you, Emmett offers Ray the stamp, as you mentioned, and Ray says in response, I'm not less than you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all Ray wants. I don't even know if it's about the stamp at the end of the day as much as Ray feels like Emmett feels that Ray is beneath him. And Ray does not feel like that. And so this is him saying, like, you know what? Screw your stamp. I just want to know from you that I'm your equal.
Yeah. And so is this just a mistake on, is this just reference to Emmett's character and just like he is not able to see that? He's just not able to realize what really upsets his brother, and that's what it is, because it makes perfect sense, of course. And I'm sure Emmett being a very successful person, I think that can happen sometimes with successful people, is even if you don't mean to, people are always going to feel like they're underneath you, like that you. Mm-hmm. And I'm not. Do you think Emmett does feel that way at this point? I mean, eventually he does reference that his brother is kind of a loser. So is it just one of these things where he does feel that way, or maybe he doesn't necessarily want to feel that way, but he just can't help it because it's just, you know, as life goes on, you kind of feel that way eventually. Like, yeah, well, you know, if my brother would just get off his seat, you know, just get out there and make something happen for himself, he could be a better person or something. I don't know. It's just interesting.
No. That's, you just brought up a great point, because I do feel like what Emmett prides himself in being is really this self-made man.
Yeah.
Of him saying, I was the one who personally made my fortune. I did it with my own two hands. American dream. I pulled myself up by my own bootstraps. And therefore, you'd have to wonder if he sort of associates Ray with being a little lazy in that, you know, he used to be a parole officer. He's dating one of his former parolees. You know, he's not necessarily it's not all his champagne dreams and caviar wishes as much as it is with Emmett. So you have to wonder if, I don't think Emmett has a malicious bone in his body, but you have to wonder if it's almost, you know, purely is subtextual or Freudian in that he's just thinking like, well, Ray is not successful, therefore he's kind of less of a person than I am. And I don't think it's malicious. I just think for him, it's sort of a fact considering how much he associates wealth with success.
Yeah. And if, you know, if Emmett was thinking about it, as soon as Ray says that line that I'm not beneath you. If he would have really thought it through, even before he gives him the stamp, that was Emmett's moment to kind of change the conversation just a tad to say, listen, I understand where you're coming from. You're not below me. You're not underneath me. You know, you're a great person. This stamp always belonged to you. Here it is. If he would have changed it just slightly a little bit to that point, then obviously I think Ray would have had a different reaction, and Ray would have had a different reaction, and, you know, Ray would still be alive today, and that stamp wouldn't have killed him.
Yeah, absolutely. And even when Emmett tries to give the stamp to Ray, it's sort of a matter of semantics where Ray says, well, you're technically not giving it to me because it was mine to begin with. Yeah. And who knows, had Emmett said, this stamp is yours, here it is, maybe Ray would have accepted it and moved on. Maybe he would have done something more drastic. Who knows? But yeah, it's as a result of, you know, these two brothers really coming to a head, that glass ends up in Ray's head.
Yeah, and I think we have talked a lot about this before, but in Ray's mind, if he would have had the stamp at the beginning, that he feels like his life would be different and he would be the Emmett. I really do feel like that, and that's why that stamp bothers him so much.
I believe Nikki said it last week, like, what's the difference between you and him? Larceny.
Yeah, right. That's right. I forgot about that. So, yeah, it's, oh man, it just, the whole thing was so tragic to see happen. I felt, yeah, and even that moment when he realizes there's a big chunk of glass in his neck, Emmett tries to say, don't pull it out.
Yeah, exactly. And Ray dies by not listening to Emmett in a variety of regards. And I don't want to label myself an Emmett apologist, but yeah, considering that, and Ray's last words are Emmett. And so I think it's just very poignant that, as a result of Ray kind of being emboldened by this new persona of, you know what, I am good enough, I'm going to stand up to you, he realizes that maybe he should have listened a couple times.
Yeah, I don't feel bad for being somewhat of an Emmett apologist, because I do think, like you said earlier, he doesn't really have a bad, you know, bone in him. I don't think he's really that bad of a person. In fact, in a way, you might say he's the better of the two brothers in the end anyway, because, you know, Ray was willing to do some pretty awful things, you know, breaks up his marriage. I mean, this Ray, before he died, really screws Emmett's personal life up big time just to get that stupid stamp back. I mean, I'm sorry, even though I love Ray because he was this lovable loser, shall we say, that you couldn't help but, you know, feel sorry for. But, you know, in a way, Emmett is not a bad person, I think, overall. And I do feel like it's okay to not totally dislike this person at this point.
Yeah, and, you know, but I feel like we should also say, RIP Ray, you know, you were also, even though people might have considered you a loser, I think you had some value to you, and it's clear that you really did love Nikki more than anything in the world. It sucks that you had to go out this way, but also from a storytelling perspective, it's amazing that you went out this way.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is amazing. One of the things I wanted to point off right away, and I'm sure you probably picked up on this as well, was that once all this takes place, poor Ray is dead. Obviously, Emmett's freaking out. He needs to have this fix. And who does he call? He does not call his former fixer, Cy. He is now calling Vargas. So in my mind, that tells me Cy really is out. He is out in Emmett's mind. It's the VM and Emmett show, no longer the Emmett and Cy show. Do you feel that way as well?
Absolutely. I mean, Emmett alluded to Cy's like, you're the fixer, you're not fixing anything last episode.
Yeah.
And I can't remember in the Ray Emmett scene, did Ray tell Emmett anything about what happened to Nikki, or are we going to assume that that information still remains under wraps?
No, that conversation did not come up that I remember, so yeah, that's under wraps.
Interesting. Yeah. So we'll wonder, maybe that Emmett will come to the surface as well at some point.
I think, because let's think about this. Emmett did not, I don't believe Emmett really heard anything that Cy has ever been telling him. That's what I'm saying. I think Emmett has been so distracted about this stuff with his brother that he's really missed all kinds of stuff. I think Emmett has no idea what VM has been doing in the sideline here he has to know a little bit. I mean, he knows about the death of their lawyer. He has to assume that VM was involved maybe in that. But I do feel like his vision has been clouded too much to where I don't think he's aware of what's going on. And yeah, correct me wrong. We could, maybe our listeners can correct me, because I do not remember that conversation taking turn where he mentioned him. But then again, you would think at this point Cy would have told him what happened, but maybe not.
Yeah, you know, maybe Cy feels like he mucked things up so badly with his attempted cash grab that he just decides, like, you know what, I'm just not going to... Sort of like he didn't tell Emmett about his run-in with Ray. You know, he said that, I'm going to take care of it, Emmett, don't worry. As a result, he got police attention on him and had to drink Vargas pee. So I feel like Cy at this point is almost self-sabotaging himself, and that he's trying to focus so much on doing well in the eyes of Emmett that he's not really focusing on, you know, the task at hand, and is not telling him, because I feel like the moment that he does tell Emmett, his reputation, anything that's left of it, is going to immediately unravel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Did you, I like the fact that because of Ray's death, Ray technically saved Nikki.
Yeah, it's really interesting where, you know, we get these, like, very, like you said, sort of edgier seat, like, very climactic shots where, you know, Nikki ominously leaves the door ajar as she goes to get ice, and we see the door kind of like edge closed, which is just so creepy. And then when Nikki comes back, she's feeling something. She gets a coat hanger, but we see that shot through the bathroom mirror of Mimo standing there. But it appears that she was saved by her own convenience, as you mentioned, as because Varga got asked to clean up this case, since I guess the Nikki, kill Nikki task has less precedence than the go to the police station task. Mimo gets called out of the line of duty. And so, yeah, Nikki is saved in a way because Ray died.
Yeah, now, is this a mistake, though, from VM to call him and say, you know, abort? I'm wondering if maybe they're going to really regret leaving Nikki alive, because I have a feeling she's not just going to leave this alone at this point.
Yeah,
you think?
They kill the less crafty of the two, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So I do want to talk to you about a quick theory here. Do you think, and I know this might be really stretching things there because we don't have all the evidence just yet, but is it possible, because I know we talked briefly about this, What did VM tell Yuri and Mimo to not kill Nikki? Was this VM's plan the whole time? Is that, let's leave her alive, let's get this to where this feud really kicks into gear, and that at some point maybe it could lead to this happening where, you know, the feud, you know, takes a turn into where someone like Ray does get killed. I mean, it does seem a bit of a far stretch, but I mean, the more, because I'm still wondering why they didn't just kill Nikki at that point. It still bothered me. And it made me wonder, like, was this part of Vargas' thing? Like, did he hope that something like this would happen, that the two of them would get in a feud, and that because, you know, Ray's kind of an idiot, he'd probably be the one to wind up being on the short end of things? I mean, what do you think about this? Is this too much of a stretch?
So when would Varga come up with this plan? Would it be after Gloria and Winnie revealed all the stuff that Ray attempted to do in the first episode? Or do you think this was a long, long con that he had planned from the beginning?
I feel like it had to be kind of a little bit longer con, because, I mean, this stems back to the decision to not kill Nikki. you know, just to injure her and piss them off. So it's a bit of a stretch, but maybe it will be proven as we learn more information. You know, maybe we will get something that will lead us more to it. I could be mm-hmm. just giving them more credit than they deserve as far as like this beautifully long, you know, con here. So we'll see how it plays out. Just something
yeah,
I was
I mean,
thinking about.
I mean, what I will say is I think Varga's quote of how, you know, things of consequence rarely happen by accident. That could be something in the camp of your theory. I'm not inclined to agree with you at this moment because I feel like this moment more so shows how Varga's able to spin a story and a yarn of a narrative on the fly where he, you know, finds out this information and in the drive over to Emmett's or to Ray's comes up with this theory that, oh no, we have to suspect Nikki. Now, I wonder if this was just him saying, okay, I'm not going to kill Nikki for right now. Let's come up with this theory because, you know, they also benefit from the fact that Nikki has been severely beaten. So you could come up with this abuse narrative. And if she claims, no, it wasn't Ray, it was these guys, you would say, oh no, you know, she clearly loves him enough that, you know, she wouldn't admit to it. So that kind of corners Nikki. So that actually tidies things up pretty nicely from a narrative perspective. I'd like to hope that Varga is as big of a con artist as he is and not really as omniscient that he's able to really set all these chess pieces in place. You know, it's no Lorne Malvo, you know, taping the fitness buff's hands to that treadmill and, you know, having it auto-fire a shotgun. I feel like Varga is not necessarily on that level as of yet.
True. So we'll see how that plays out. I mean, I definitely think he wanted, I think he definitely, the reaction he wanted to get from leaving Nikki alive was to kind of maybe stir some anger between, even more anger between the two brothers. Whether or not he really thought, oh, well, this could lead to, you know, one of them being killed, hard to say. That might be a bit of a stretch there, but it does make me wonder how much he has, what his overall plans have been and how long he's been thinking about it and what is the end game, what does he exactly for sure want from the Stussy brothers. I mean, it's we'll see how this thing plays out. Let's talk for a quick second as we close things out. Vargas, of course, gives Emmett some instructions on what to do when he goes to this dinner meeting with Goldfarb and Sai, talking about going through the back of the restaurant and all this stuff, washing your hands in cold water. All these are, by the way, great things if any of you people are, you know, involved in such a terrible thing and you're trying to hide what you've been up to. But I have this feeling that Emmett is, you know, he's still pretty so shell-shocked, shall we say, of what happened here with his brother. I could totally see him screwing this up and just walking right in that restaurant, and this could really come back to bite him because you know that now Gloria and Winnie, the two beautiful female detective team here, is they're going to find out about, of course, the death of Ray. This is going to really heat things up. I mean, we do see the episode closing with Gloria wanting to head back to question more about what is going on between, you know, this VM guy and Emmett. But this is, what do you think? I think he's going to screw this up a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this plan could work for someone of Varga's, you know, state of mind, but I feel like Emmett is so rattled, especially by the death of his own brother, that he's probably going to fumble a lot of things, not even this dinner, but moving forward, which I think makes him more and more of a loose end for Varga to have to tie up. It'll make for some fantastic scenes. And, you know, I will say, as we mourn Ray as well, I think we will also acknowledge the really fantastic work that was done in both of those parts. Ewan McGregor really did a powerhouse performance, in my point of view, with playing both of these characters, that they each had their own separate personas and they acted completely differently. It did not seem like a pair of twins as we might have initially believed. So all the kudos to Mr. McGregor for really putting in the work and producing two separate, distinct, and very interesting characters.
Absolutely, I agree. I know that the big question was, how is this going to work with him playing both of the brothers? And I agree with you. I think he did a superb job, and I'm not surprised. I mean, I follow his work outside of the Star Wars franchise, and am very aware of the fact that this is a man who has great acting chops. So I am not surprised whatsoever. He did a beautiful job, like you said, establishing the two brothers and how different they are, even though they're similar in some ways. I loved it. That's one of the big things I wrote down was is that I'm a little sad, Mike. I'm sad because now this feud between the brother feud, which I was hoping, you know, would continue to heat up, is now over. So I kind of do wonder, like, you know, it's going to leave us a little bit empty for the last four episodes because now we don't have that anymore. Do you feel the same way? Something's going to be missing now from this story.
I see where you're coming from in that this is where we started, but I feel like this just shows how complex the story has gotten or how much it's progressed in that,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've only gotten, it was only doted upon a couple of, you know, scenes in the past few episodes. Last episode, we got the two of them yelling at each other on the bus. This episode, we got the two of them facing off the apartment, but it seems like we've gotten very few scenes of the two brothers in the same room together. So I don't mm-hmm. know how much we're losing with, you know, having only one brother alive, especially since we've been progressing so much and all these other characters have gotten involved, and how much the death of Ray is really going to light another spark in this fireworks show.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, Act 1 being so much about this feud and how it everything because of the feud has spiraled into where we're at now, and how, you know, the second half is going to show that this stupid feud between the two of them is probably going to lead to you know, the entire Stussy family really just being demolished because of this whole thing. I mean, we can't imagine things ending very well, and DM, of course, being a major part of that. So it'll be exciting to see how this plays out, to see what is his long-term goal here as far as what his plans are for the Stussy industry, and mainly Emmett as well. Things are not going to go well for Cy, I think. Now, whether or not he'll survive this thing, I thought he was going to die in this episode. I think I mentioned it, Dev. I thought if anybody was going to die, major character, I thought it was going to be Cy first. But unfortunately for Ray, it was Ray. And we'll see. I still don't think Cy's long for this world very long. What do you think?
Yeah, especially now that, you know, Varga's really becoming Emmett's number one, and the whole narrative has been spurning Cy, ejecting him from the royal court of Stussy. I would not be surprised if they decide to tie up that loose end as well by saying, you know, especially considering they intercepted Cy trying to do his own wheeling and dealing without informing Emmett by saying, you know what, Cy's got to go.
Yeah, I agree. So we'll see how that plays out. I'm interested. I'm excited. Who knows? Maybe Cy will surprise us and be heavily responsible for taking VM down. That would be a really big turn of events, and he could finally be that badass that he always wanted to be. So who knows? Maybe he could sort of be our hero in the end. You never know. Mm-hmm. And these are very smart writers, so they may surprise us again and take a turn that we were not expecting. So lots of great stuff for us to talk about here, I'm sure, the next four episodes. And Mike, I'm glad that you are my partner in crime, my Winnie here. I'd probably be more the Winnie, though. You're probably more Gloria than me.
Yeah, but, well, I don't know. I'm probably easier to look up online than you, so I might be more Winnie in that regard.
That's true. Me and you do have a bigger digital print, online digital yes. print than anyone that poor Gloria has. I mean, but me and you spend a lot of time online, so there's no surprise that we are easily found when you Google our names, especially my name, because I really don't know if there's very many Jeremiah Panhorses out in the universe. So my name is the only one that comes up in the first six search the pages of Google. It's all me.
So you are, if Varga is on the case, you are
I'm
pretty much cornered, my friend. Yeah.
I am trouble. He does not have to break out too heavily on his Mr. Robot skills because I'm easy to find, that's for sure. Well, Mike, let's go ahead and close this thing down. It was a great episode. Should we go ahead and let everybody know how they can follow us on Twitter and contact us? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, I did not receive any feedback. I feel bad because I did not send out a reminder. I was so busy with work and the Survivor finale this week, so I did not send out a reminder for anyone. But did you receive anything, Mike?
No, I have not, but that's okay, because you can always reach out to us, whether it's after the episode or before, letting us know your thoughts on Fargo Season 3. in general. Like we said, we have pretty big digital footprints at this point. You can follow us on Twitter. Jeremiah is at jpanhorst. I am at a Mike Bloom type. And yeah, feel free to let us know your thoughts on this season so far, especially this action-packed episode. You can also, if you have longer term thoughts, email fargowithmj@gmail.com. Again, that's fargowithmj@gmail.com. If you send us feedback before we record, we'll read it on air like we did last week. So let us know your thoughts. If you're not subscribed yet, please make sure you're subscribed to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike on iTunes. Just search those words exactly and you'll find it. And we're always appreciative of any ratings and reviews you leave as well. Thank you so much to those listeners for letting us know how much you enjoy the podcast. We greatly appreciate it. That also, we are part of the Jay and Jack Network. So make sure you're subscribed to the whole enchilada and check out all the other great stuff that they do on the network. I've been covering The Leftovers final season with Jay and Jack. We only have two episodes left. It has been a wackadoo season, and I'm so excited to see where it goes from here. We've got The Broadcast, The Merry Man Show, which is now, I believe, under a name reconstruction. Survivor with Jay, Jack, and Colleen just finished up. So there is so much happening in the Jay and Jack podcast universe. Make sure you do not miss a second of it.
Yeah, that's right. I listen to a lot of it. It's great content, everyone. Definitely check it out. You will not be disappointed, I promise. So, Mike, this has been a pleasure, my friend, and you take care, and I'll see you next week, okay?
Yep, you take care as well.